So this is kind of amazing. The same guy who masterminded this. For my theme song, like my leather black jeans on, like my by any means on, partin' I'm getting my screen. Also produced this. I know I have a fickle heart and a bitterness and a wandering eye and a heaviness in my head. And this. Nothing can stop me now, cause I don't care anymore. And this.
There'll be a golden letter reaching down. When the man comes around.
In the recording industry, there are producers, and then there are producers. And then there's Rick Rubin, who's more like some kind of music wizard. 30 years ago, when he was still in college, he joined up with Russell Simmons to found the pioneering hip-hop label Def Jam. Together, they launched a music empire, producing important records by Public Enemy, LL Cool J, and the Beastie Boys, among others. But just as Def Jam and hip-hop began to get really big, Rubin left, started his own label, and diversified. Since then, he's worked with scores of artists, from Nine Inch Nails to Johnny Cash, Metallica, Neil Diamond, the Dixie Chicks, Jay-Z. I could go on. Rick Rubin, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, a pleasure meeting you.
And you. And to start, I want to play one of the first songs you produced back in 1984. It's Yours by Tila Rock and Jazzy Jay. Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some of the musical myths, seeking people of the universe. This is Yours. So there you are, going to NYU, this suburban kid who'd listened to punk rock, and suddenly you're at the center of this new hip-hop thing in New York City. How did that happen?
Well, I was hard at the center of it. I was witnessing what was happening, and it felt like a magical time in music because there was this new energy, and it felt like very much like punk rock, but different. And I think the difference between hip-hop and punk rock was a lot of people rejected punk rock, whereas a lot of people accepted hip-hop.
And is that partly because punk rock, part of the punk rock ethos, was to seek rejection?
I don't think so. I just think people didn't get it as much, or the audience wasn't as open-minded towards it. My particular case, I'm an only child, and I think most of the other kids that I went to school with kind of got their musical taste from their older brothers and sisters. It kind of got passed down.
Uh-huh.
And because I didn't have that, whatever was going on at the moment had more potential for me to engage in it. And at that time, punk rock was the one that spoke to me.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in hip hop, it was different. And with hip hop, it seemed like there was a much more of a community right from the beginning of people embracing it.
And pretty soon, you're founding Def Jam Records with Russell Simmons. You're producing these huge albums for Run DMC and LL Cool J and Public Enemy. What was it like being the white guy in the middle of this black musical revolution?
It was a little strange in that everybody else was black. But very quickly, as soon as we started talking about music, after the initial shock of them meeting me, after that, it was all good.
And then you helped introduce the first big white rappers to the world in the Beastie Boys. I want to play a little bit of the new style from their debut record in 1986, Licensed to Ill.
Let me clear my throat. Kick it over here, baby pop. And let all the fly skimmers feel the beat. Drop. Oh. Cooling on the corner.
So just after you've exposed rap music to the wider world, you let these three artsy, upper-middle-class Jewish kids kind of walk all over it. Did that seem like a very transgressive punk rock thing to do at the time?
Well, we were all friends from punk rock. The Beasties were a punk rock band before they became a rap band. And I would say we always had a sort of a punk rock aesthetic in all the Def Jam stuff. It was like a renegade version of hip-hop.
And all of that early Def Jam hip-hop, Run DMC and Public Enemy, and all sounds of its time, and yet today has such staying power. And you hear all these songs in movies and in bars. And does it surprise you, that sort of endurance?
It's hard to say. I had no expectation of anybody really ever hearing this music. We made it really for our friends. That said, we thought it was really good. And I just think the perspective that we made it from, it wasn't about being timely. It was about being pure and good and capturing a real moment. So real moments tend to sound good always.
You'll always be associated with the rap music of the 80s, but you'll also always be associated with the late career resurgence of Johnny Cash. I want to play a little bit of I See a Darkness from American 3, Solitary Man, which came out in 2000.
And light it up forever and never go to sleep, my best unbeaten brother, this isn't all I see.
Did Johnny Cash come to you, or did you go to him?
I went to him. I had an idea because I had a new label at the time, and all of the artists I was working with were first-time artists, young artists, and I thought it'd be a fun challenge to find a grown-up artist who maybe hadn't been doing their best work and try to help them recapture what was great about them. And Johnny was the first person I thought of.
You've said that the music industry does a terrible job of properly cherishing artists who have been around for a long time. I wonder if your, you know, universally acclaimed and successful work with Johnny Cash changed that industry instinct at all.
Well, I do know one of the things that it shifted was several other older artists that I met in the wake of that had a renewed sense of possibility of doing good work.
Speaking of older artists, Neil Diamond. You made an album with him about a decade ago called 12 Songs.
You can tell them this. Hell yeah, he did. He saw it all. He walked the line. Never had to crawl. He cried a bit. But not for long.
How did that come about? Did Neil Diamond come to you and say, hey, do for me what you did for Johnny Cash?
Okay, I'll say that is not exactly the way it happened. I went to him.
Uh-huh.
I pursued him for a long time just because
really?
I'm a big fan of his early work, and I thought it would be really fun to make a great Neil Diamond record. And it was so different than anything I'd done before.
Yes.
Which is always an interesting challenge for me. It's really fun to find new creative challenges.
In the last few years, you've returned to hip-hop in a big way, producing for Jay-Z and Eminem and Kanye West. What is it like now mentoring artists, Eminem and Kanye certainly, who grew up on the music you produced 30 years ago? They must regard you differently as this 50-year-old wizard than people did 30 years ago as this 25-year-old kid.
Punk.
Punk, okay.
It's hard to say. I will say very quickly when you get into the actual work, all that stuff goes away. And same from my side, you know, when I get to work with, if I go into the studio with someone like Neil Young or, you know, so there are certain people who are really important artists to me. Initially, when you are around these people, there's a sense of intimidation just because their body work is so great. But very quickly, when you start listening to the music and talking about the music, all that stuff goes away and it really is just about music.
Right. Kanye came to you, I've read, last year, just weeks before his album Yeezus was supposed to be released. Were you not tempted to say, no, we can't do it in this amount of time? We can't fix whatever you need fixing?
Yeah, I didn't think it was realistic or doable. And then it ended up being, we probably worked for probably about 20 days every day. It was really a challenging and fun process.
I'm doing 500, I'm out of control. But there's nowhere to go, and there's no way to slow. If I knew what I knew in the past, I would have beamed like that on your
And it was a huge album and acclaimed by everybody, so it apparently worked. But I'm wondering, given this intensity, and was that kind of interesting for your process, since that's not presumably how you work ordinarily?
Yeah, it is not how I work at all. And and I was panicky, and he was completely cool.
Huh.
And as it turns out, it's the way he works best. So while it was an unusual experience for me, I think ultimately it's about what works for the artist.
It strikes me, just talking to you today, that part of your wizardry is your even-keeledness with artists in these what can be, we know, very frenetic, pressure, difficult times of making a record. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I try to bring to the table when we're working is a sense of all of those things which ultimately get in the way of the art being great. We don't include those in our conversation. And we don't talk about, you know, what's going to get on the radio and what's going to, you know, how are we going to make our release date. We talk about how do we make this song as good as it could be? Is this song good enough? Which of these songs are better? Those are the conversations. And when the sole focus is on making good things and you clear the decks of all of the noise, it so far has yielded really great results.
Well, Rick Rubin, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Def Jam Records is celebrating its 30th anniversary right now with reissues of some of their truly groundbreaking albums, from Public Enemy's Icon to Kanye West's 808s and Heartbreak. Hit me. Look.